Live from the launching pad in Sedona, Arizona, this is the Progressive Technology Hour, and I'm your host, Dr. Houdini. I would like to welcome you to a truly unique talk show program that focuses on exotic technologies. What are exotic technologies? Well, this includes such areas as free energy, gravity, anti-gravity control, the study of the nature of time and time travel. We'll explore not only the technology, but also the how-to part of the technology. So let's have some fun today and explore the world of exotic technologies. Folks, yes, we are putting on a expo that we plan to do next year in 2011, and it's called I Am Ready Expo. And you can visit a website we have. It's called IamReadyExpo.com. And we just met with a sales manager over here in downtown Phoenix, where we're planning on putting this on at the Phoenix Convention Center next year. And the dates, Aurora, for the conference, March 18th, 19th, and 20th. So this is on a weekend, starting Friday on the 18th, March 18th. So mark your calendars, you know, for this special event. And the focus, folks, is going to be on surviving 2012. You know, that's our whole focus of this expo. So we're going to be pushing underground shelters. And also we're going to be getting into co-op programs. Okay, so that we can build little communities, you know, around these shelters that anyone can join. You can join into the expo. Or
focusing.
And, okay, Aurora. That's Aurora Light, my producer of the show.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for having
Aurora.
Me on, William.
Yes, yes. And, we're going to be focusing on underground shelters and all the support systems, okay, that are around these shelters. So that includes hydroponic systems, aquaponics, food storage systems, alternative energy systems, everything you need to essentially survive underground for up to a year. So,
yeah, the idea would be to form little communities.
Yes, yes, that anyone can join.
Dentists, doctors, people like that.
Yes.
That can help a community thrive, too. People with skills.
Yes, yes. Skills driven.
Skills count.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's what it's going to take for people to not be dependent on FEMA and the FEMA camps.
Yes.
Now we know why they got all those FEMA camps ready.
Oh yeah.
And 100,000, they were placing orders for tents from tent manufacturers in Arkansas that I connected with. 100,000 a year. What are they doing with all these tents?
Well, they're planning for something big here. You know, a huge catastrophe's coming, folks, and the government is prepared. And the question is, are you prepared for what's to come? Okay. And I'll tell you, what's coming is not a pretty scene at all.
It's not a day at the park.
No.
It's going to be a little more intense than the E-ride at Disney.
Oh, yes. And, you know, if you saw the movie 2012, you know, where the government, they build these huge arcs. Well, these arcs have been built, folks. Okay, they're called underground cities and underground bases. And, you know, they're ready. You know, they're ready for what's to come here.
And they're ready, but they, are we? No. Yeah. The people.
No, no. We're fed with news by Disney. You know, we're given a an artificial world, really, that doesn't really exist.
That's right.
You know, a day at the ballpark.
Shut up and listen and stand up straight and march to the left, to the right, forward, stop, march. You know, it's all a manipulation.
Distraction. It's all a distraction.
It's all manipulation.
What's really going on over here?
But we're going to have a guest on today who's going to help clear up the reality of the situation for a lot of people.
And his name is John DiNardo. And John has been a frequent guest on the Sheldon Day Show. And he's been providing quite a few YouTube videos and these sound bites, which are just stunning.
Well, you know, it's hard for most people to believe when, you know, you go shopping, you see everybody at the mall, you know, they're buying, you know, trivia, they're having fun at all the restaurants. It doesn't look like we're in a pre-preparatory stage for a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't look that way. So
no,
it's hard
it doesn't
to believe
look that
one's
way at
coming.
All. And a lot of stories are being underreported, and we're going to get into some of those stories today.
Do you have any that you would like to share with us right now?
Well, John DiNardo.
Oh, does he? Did he? He's got some stories.
Going to be getting into that.
All right.
And what I want to do is play one of his clips here.
Okay.
It's from James McCanney back in 2000, right around the 2003-2004 time frame when James was talking about a mini solar system entering ours. So let's go ahead and play this clip.
There seems to be some serious observation going on in the southern hemisphere and leaks coming out all over the place. It does appear that groups of military and professional astronomers are openly active, let's say, at the Wormwood location in Australia.
Okay, I want to stop it right there, the Wormwood location. So, I mean, how much more evidence do you need, folks?
They named it Wormwood after the destroyer in the Bible.
Yeah.
So they know what it is.
Oh, yeah.
They're well aware.
Well, of course, that's what I've been saying all along. The indicators were all there. And now there are reports that a mini solar system is coming into ours. There's no time frame.
Okay, well, that was a clip there.
What year was that done?
Right around the 2003-2004 time frame. Does that sound about right, John?
Oh, are we welcoming John
June,
at this time?
June 17th, 2004.
2004.
John, thanks for being with us today.
Yes.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be with you and your audience.
So, John, when you called it the Wormwood facility, where is this Wormwood facility?
I believe it's the Worm Project, Wormwood, at the Learmonth Observatory in Australia. The southern hemisphere is the optimal location for viewing this planet coming in below our ecliptic plane. The ecliptic plane is that invisible, huge invisible disk in space on which all the planets on our solar system revolve around the sun. So if it's coming in below, that's below the feet of this planet, footprint of planet Earth, then it has to be viewed in the southern hemisphere, ideally from the South Pole. And incidentally, that's exactly where they built in 2007. They completed the construction of the secret South Pole telescope. It has not been revealed to the public, but the public has paid for it with many millions of dollars. Here in the harshest environment imaginable, where a person could not even exist for a short period of time unless they had a special building in to survive in, and that's exactly what they did at the South Pole telescope, because they needed to go down there. They never would have gone to that point had it not been necessary.
And it was necessary in order to view this coming in from the most strategic point?
That's right. That's where you have the best viewing location. And incidentally, Marshall Masters had posted on his website of YOWUSA.com very important incident in which someone leaked the information, a sighting of Planet X from Project Wormwood. From the South Pole Telescope. And this was on YouTube back around January of 2008. And you can still see it on Marshall Masters' website.
I heard about that. I heard about that YouTube video.
Yes, and Marshall Masters said in his, he's actually got a video about it on his website in which he says that within one day that footage, either was a still picture or it was film footage of Planet X taken from the South Pole Telescope, and within one day that footage was taken down from YouTube. And then the next day or two, somebody got on there claiming to be that very same person, the very same whistleblower, and saying that, oh, it was just a hoax. It was just a joke. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that was the government silencing this person and then trying to take his identity away from him.
There is a law.
This person may be dead. This person may have been killed. We don't know.
Right. Mm. There is a law in place that says if you do anything that would cause mass panic, you know, you're under arrest.
I believe it. I mean, they make laws a lot less less serious than that. I mean, over most trivial act, a person can be put in violation of some law that they created unconstitutionally. So this kind of law seems perfectly logical, considering the kind of people we're dealing with who control our government. You see, it certainly would be logical just to try to prevent public panic. But in a situation where the public needs to know critical information that could save their lives, save the lives of millions of people, then we've got an evil government that would try to stifle that information.
Oh, it's an evil government, all right.
Well, first of all, you have to think of it logically. If they were to release the fact that this is a reality, then people would say, well, what preparatory arrangements have you made for us? And then they'd have to reveal their own preparatory arrangements. And then everyone would be very ticked off that there was none for them.
So we reveal this to the public.
So, you know, I can see why they have chosen not to reveal it.
Right, and you can see the opportunity we have here. Because, you know, when you speak to millions of Americans, if we were to reach many, many millions of Americans through a network, not only your website, not only your radio program, but other radio programs, most people are apathetic. They want to sit back and hide from the truth, from the ugly reality of a government that's gone out of control and that's abusing their rights.
And go to their favorite sports bar.
That's right. They
want to go to the corner and go to the sports bar and shoot and watch a sports game on TV.
Yes, it's disgusting how irresponsible people have become. However, when there's a situation such as this where people know that they are doomed unless they take immediate action, even the most apathetic and cowardly person will begin to move to protect himself and his family. It's a survival instinct. And that's why the government is deathly afraid that people will find out about this. We have a great opportunity to spread this information first, that we have to do it cleverly to get it out as quickly as possible so that they don't come down on us and single us out.
Well, they can't.
There are enough of us already who are talking.
We're already running convention centers, putting up billboards. We're going to be going for it all the way.
Right.
Have you been in contact with David at alienshift.com?
No.
He's got a conferencing out of Los Angeles. I forget the name. I'm trying to remember, but I can send you. He's on Facebook.
I have no idea.
He has done teleconferencing with various people regarding Planet X, trying to bring them together in a similar way that you're doing by having conferences. And he works out of Los Angeles. They've already had a big conference in Los Angeles, I think, this year.
Well, watch out for the black ops. That's all I can say. This field is littered with them. I've been in it for 30 years, and I can tell you it's a maze of smoke and mirrors.
Well, you're probably right. I mean, that's something we have to watch out for.
Oh, but, you know, God, there's so many of them, too.
We have a grand opportunity, though, because this is an issue that will get even the most apathetic person in motion,
mm-hmm.
and warning his relatives about it, because it's something they have to do, no matter how lazy they are and cowardly they may be. They're going to have to, they know they'll have to get in motion and prepare themselves. So once we get a network of information out, but here's how we do it, like a pyramid. It would be, we reach the most dedicated people, people like you, people like Sheldon Day, the most extraordinary people who are dedicated to truth, who have gone to the length of actually creating a broadcast network, a broadcast station where they want to reach the people. These are the people we have to focus on bringing this information to, and not worry about going to the individual who has just an email address and doesn't really communicate very much.
Yeah, we've got to activate the activists first.
That's right, exactly. Mm-hmm. We want to avoid the dead ends and go toward the main thoroughfares of human
consciousness. Going to be the top 2%. The top 2%, like it always is.
There you go. That's how to do it. Very briefly, to give you a background on the site, on the credibility of Planet X, and we'll make it very brief because people are beginning to realize from the events that are exploding all around them throughout the world that something's wrong. We don't really need a lot of convincing, but I'm going to try to make this brief. The federal government of the United States has announced that Planet X exists, and the federal government of the United States has already announced that they have sighted Planet X. And when did this happen? People might say, well, it happened in 1983. That's old news. No, that old news becomes new news. Because the fact is, they did cite it. They announced it in the New York Times, the largest newspaper in the United States, along with the Washington Post, the second largest newspaper in the United States. And it was, the information came directly from the federal government. That is the National Aeronautics and Space Administration of the United States government. When these people were able to put the information out before the controllers of information, the secretists at the top of the National Security Agency knew what was going on. They lost control of manipulation of the public momentarily. And then they finally quickly stifled this information, and there it died since 1983. So there's powerful evidence right there. If I can show you the articles, which I have right in front of me. And
now, when were these articles first shown the light of day?
1983, they revealed it, announced it to the public, the government of the U.S. did, and then they put a lid on it. So there's proof, the fact that this announcement has been stifled. Okay, I'm going to read you. Try to make note of these dates. January 30th, 1983, New York Times. I've got the article, the actual article that I photocopied, and I emailed this photocopy as a JPEG file and a PDF file to many people. You can get it too. The title of New York Times report, January 30th, 1983, is Clues Get Warm in the Search for Planet X by John Noble Wilford. Quote, something out there beyond the farthest reaches of the known solar system seems to be tugging at Uranus and Neptune. Some gravitational force keeps perturbing the two giant planets, causing irregularities in their orbits. The force suggests a presence far away and unseen, a large object that may be the long-sought Planet X. End of quote. We go on in the article to state that astronomers historically have noticed that this planet must exist, and they have noticed it ever since about 200 years ago when they saw perturbations in the outer planets. That is a plucking of the outer gas giants Uranus and Neptune at one specific point in those planets' orbital course around the sun. And they realized that there was only one explanation for such a bizarre phenomenon, and that is there must be a huge object which exerts such a gravitational pull due to its tremendous mass that it would actually pull these planets out of their orbit at that particular point. They went on to other astronomers such as Percival Lowell. Now, this discovery, I should tell you, of the gravitational pulls on the outer planets, according to this article from NASA in the New York Times, goes back to the early 1800s. Imagine that. And just imagine how far away this planet must have been. when it exerted these forces. If it took 200 years, say from 1800 to the year 2000, and now around the year 2003, it has we sort of detected that it probably broke through the heliosphere at the outer bounds of our solar system. So it took about from the 1800 to the year 2000 to get here. It must have been incredibly far away around the year 1800 when they noticed these perturbations in the outer planets. Despite its great, great distance away from our outer solar system, it was still able to exert this noticeable plucking force, these perturbations on the orbital courses of Uranus and Neptune. Therefore, this planet must be extremely large. Well, in this newspaper article, they give you a clue. This goes back to 83, but yet even our scientific people at the top had an idea as to what this planet was or what this object was. And it says here, their best belief is that it is a brown dwarf star. I'm going to read right from the end of the article because the article is too lengthy and we don't have the time to get into it. But at the end of this article from NASA through the New York Times says, more credence, quote, more credence was given to the hypothesis that a brown dwarf star accounts for this mysterious force. Okay, now, a brown dwarf star, look up the definition. If you go to wikipedia.org, you will find that a brown dwarf star is a body that's a small sun. It never got large enough to actually light up and ignite as our sun does. Our sun, incidentally, is 330,000 Earth masses. Our sun is 1/3 of a million Earth masses. Now, a brown dwarf star never got that big. And by definition, according to Wikipedia.org, and probably most other encyclopedias, a puny brown dwarf star would be about three Jupiter masses. Well, one Jupiter itself has a mass of 318 Earths. So three Jupiter masses, and we're being very conservative in calling this a very puny brown dwarf star. We don't know that. Well, then, if it were a puny brown dwarf star, it would be three Jupiters or almost 1,000 Earth masses.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would make sense, Jim.
Have some insight connections. Yeah. He believes it may. It's probably, he's not sure, nobody's sure, unless you're really high up in the government.
Mm-hmm.
But he believes it's somewhere around 10 Jupiters, which would make it like over 3,000 Earth
Jupiters.
Masses. So anyway, now you can understand why it would exert a noticeable perturbation in the outer gas giants Uranus and Neptune even 200 years ago when it was incredibly far out in deep space.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now it's coming in. We have the sightings in later years. Percival Lowell erected the Lowell Observatory specifically dedicated to sighting Planet X. This was in the year 1900. Percival Lowell died. And around 1930, the astronomers still working at the Lowell Observatory was Clyde Tombaugh. He became famous because in the process of looking for Planet X, and you'll see this on one of the Discovery Channel or BBC, Discovery Channel presentations on the discovery of Pluto, you'll find out that they announced that Clyde Tombaugh was actually looking for Planet X. So even in this Discovery Channel program, they admit the existence of Planet X. Anyway, we go on further into modern, it's the middle of the 20th century, and the government of the United States puts out a document, a internal document, and NASA is always secret. Everything they put out is secret. It's supposed to be. It's never to be revealed to the public. That is their charter. They put out an internal document around 1978 titled The Search for Planet X. So even NASA admitted in their own internal documents that Planet X exists.
Now, what year?
Around 1978. You can do a search on that. You probably find it on the Internet. It may be out there now. NASA document titled The Search for Planet X. And consequently, 5 years later, they designed and developed and launched the infrared astronomical satellite dedicated only to finding Planet X, which it did. I just read the article from January 30th. That article in the New York Times commemorated the launching of this joint venture between the United States government and the government of the Netherlands of the infrared astronomical satellite. And they proudly announced before the controllers of information silenced NASA, they proudly announced that they were going to look for Planet X. Well, ironically, coincidentally, 11 months later, exactly 11 months later, not January 30th, 1983, but December 30th, 1983, and I got that photocopy also. I have both the New York Times and the Washington Post photocopied articles.
And are these up on your website, or where can we find these?
Okay, yeah, let's see. I put out, it's in high resolution.
Is there some that you can send to Bill so we can put up on Vortex Network News? Because we'd love to have a section devoted to your information up there.
I could email you those.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Yeah, they'd be fine.
I've got several. I could send you the CD where you can, that I have.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
High resolution photocopies of these New York Times, Washington Post, and U.S. News and World Report.
Oh, we'd be really happy to do that for our listeners.
Okay. I'll have to do that tonight. Okay. In the 11 months later, December 30th, 1983, I've got this photocopy of the Washington Post, front page, Washington Post. Here's the title of the article. Mystery Heavenly Body Discovered, Possibly as Large as Jupiter, by Thomas O'Toole, Washington Post staff writer, page one. Quote, a heavenly body, possibly as large as the giant planet Jupiter, and possibly so close to Earth that it would be part of this solar system, has been found in the direction of the constellation Orion by an orbiting telescope aboard the U.S. Infrared Astronomical Satellite. So mysterious is the object that astronomers do not know if it is a planet, a giant comet, a nearby protostar, which incidentally is a brown dwarf star, a protostar, that never got hot enough to become a star, etc. So anyway, this is what their main speculation is. They say the scientists believe that it is probably a brown dwarf star. So here you have them stating twice that the government officials at NASA believe that it is a brown dwarf star. So here we have almost...
Now, John, you know, what's interesting...
This thing is huge.
What's interesting about that article is that they put that brown dwarf over there in the northern hemisphere, Orion. Now, do you think that was disinformation?
You know, that was disinfo. You're right. That's a good point. Orion. In other words, you're saying Orion, if you look out from in space at the celestial sphere,
right,
which is all the constellations around us viewed from Earth, you would have to be looking up in the northern hemisphere, not from the southern hemisphere,
exactly,
to see Orion, right?
That's right.
So they deliberately turned everybody's heads in the other direction.
And I don't think you can see it from the Wormwood location.
We're just there, cut off. He's gone.
There you,
are you there, John? Okay.
Yes, so I'm there.
Okay, I heard a big boom. I thought, oops.
Oh, no. Well, no, you're right, Bill. That's a good point. I haven't thought about that. Mm-hmm. Someone told me that Orion thing, it might have been Gilbert Erickson. I'm not sure. You probably had Gilbert on your show before.
Yes, we had a whole series. We had a series of interviews with Gilbert.
Yeah, we did quite a series, yeah.
Gilbert might have been the source of information that I think that said it was disinformation. Sometimes they'll plant a little bit of disinformation in there. Mm-hmm. They have to, you know, even though they were not fully controlled by the NASA, you know, dictators at the top or the National Security Administration or secretists at the top, they might have still been told to add a little bit of disinformation because, of course, they don't want to.
They want us looking over here.
In a direction where others could find it, too. Pardon me?
Yes. They want us looking over here where the real action is over there.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably why they came out with the story, so that they would point everyone in the wrong direction.
It's coming in, but look over here. You know, don't look over there.
Mm-hmm. Now, when that article was put out on December 30th, 1983, the National Security Administration handlers ordered everyone to be quiet, and not a word was spoken about it since then. However, something has leaked out, and I got a photocopy of this article, too, which is going to be on the CD of news articles that I'll send you. It's from the U.S. News and World Report. It's dated. I've got the date at the bottom of the page, September 10th, 1984. This slipped out. The title is Planet X, Is It Really Out There? And here's just a few sentences from the beginning of the article. Quote, shrouded from the sun's light, mysteriously tugging at the orbits of Uranus and Neptune is an unseen force that astronomers suspect may be Planet X, a 10th resident of the Earth's celestial neighborhood. Last year, the infrared astronomical satellite, IRAS, circling in a polar orbit 560 miles from the Earth. Incidentally, they don't tell you which pole was south or north pole. It must have been the south pole that it was orbiting around. 560 miles from the Earth, detected heat from an object about 50 billion miles away that is now the subject of intense speculation. Quote, all I can say is that we don't know what it is yet, says Jerry Neugebauer, director of the Palomar Observatory for the California Institute of Technology. Well, anyway, I won't go on further, but there's your third
article. Palomar
is
Northern Hemisphere. Palomar.
Pardon me?
Palomar? That's Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah, but you know what they do? They have radio telescope links, so anything that's
viewed
by this telescope is going to be downlinked to all the observatories on the planet. And going back a little bit to here, I got the New York Times, another New York Times article. This predates the June 30th, 1983 article. And it's New York Times, June 19th, 1982. This was when they sent up Pioneer 10 and 11 space probes. Pioneer 10 was sent out in the direction where all their calculations showed that Planet X would be. The reason was sent out and to go straight out into deep space and try to pass right by where they believed Planet X was. The reason was for sending this out was to detect any perturbations in the trajectory of the space probe Pioneer 10, which indeed they did. They detected perturbation in the space probe, and that's what this article was talking about.
Well, John, let me stop you right there. You know, I recall back around 2005, you know, NASA launched this big project, okay, to have scientists from around the world figure out why the Pioneer probes were slowing down out there. They didn't know, you know, they claimed, you know, NASA didn't know why their probes, these two probes, Pioneer, what is it, 9 and 10, were actually slowing, you know, something was pulling on them, okay?
Was it both probes? Both probes were being slowed down?
I believe so.
It could have been one. So it's a critical piece of information
because
the Pioneer 10 went out, was sent out in a direction where Planet X was. Pioneer 11 was sent out in just the opposite direction into deep space to act as a controlled space probe so that they could compare. They could say, well, here's the control. Here's the normal trajectory that Pioneer 11 should exhibit going in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the normal trajectory characteristics, which we can compare with those of the Pioneer 10, which is the one that's going to detect the perturbation. So when you compare one with the other, you can see some distinct difference between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if both of them slow down, then there's something in space that's slowing them both down, unrelated to Planet X. If the only one of them, Pioneer 10, is slowing down, then evidently, you know, you have an influence, a gravitational influence. You know, but there are other things out there. There's a lot of electrical plasma being blown out into deep space.
Mm-hmm.
And the heliosphere, which is a plasma-composed sphere surrounding the entire solar system, way far out beyond Pluto, that heliosphere exerts electrical forces.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very conceivable that the heliosphere could be acting to slow it down. There's also what's called a heliopause, where the outer plasma around the heliosphere interacts with gases from space. I don't know. I haven't studied it too deeply because it's not too important. But there's probably some, you know, very logical scientific explanations as to why they might slow down due to these electrical forces out there.
Or it could be that NASA's, you know, wants to build a database of who knows about Planet X. You know, what real astronomers.
Who do they need to kill or buy off?
Yeah,
and you know, they're getting to the point where they're going to have to go underground. They're getting desperate, and they probably are starting to care less and less about who knows, because once they get underground and lock those 30-ton steel doors, you know, at the base of the bowels of Cheyenne Mountain beneath the Denver airport, and there are 130 other underground facilities, then they won't care.
We got one right here in Sedona.
Well, at least an access
right here in Las Vegas is a huge one. Marshall Masters documents that in his book, Planet X forecast. The one
we're going to have him on our show.
Yeah,
we're going to have Marshall on our show.
Yeah, we have to have him on.
Well, he already agreed to do the show.
He talks about Phil Schneider, the geologist who worked for the U.S. government building these underground bases, who went public and he was murdered. A very courageous man. They tried to kill him a number of times, and he stated they were trying to kill him. But yet he continued to reveal this evidence to the people.
It's too late now. It's out there.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, there's no killing people nowadays. It's all out there.
Yeah. Everything's right out there now.
You know, so, I mean, we were sorry to hear about these people lost their lives, but at this point, there's just so many people who know it's worthless for them to continue to do that.
That's right, especially people in the government who do not have condominium underground, who are very willing to go public because they're not going to be protected.
Yeah, there's a lot of those.
The middle echelons of government are going to start talking. People in the NSA, people in the CIA, who there's no place for them.
People who built the facilities who aren't included.
Yes, and so all these people, especially the ones in government who have high credibility, are going to lose their loyalty to the devils at the top.
Well, see, you know, people who built. Think about it: the construction workers and the people who built those facilities, who thought they were building them in case of a nuclear war or something, now realizing that the government is just going to use them for themselves, and that the hell with everybody else. They might come forward, those construction workers and engineers who worked on those projects.
I think there's going to be a real explosion of information about this. And, you know, people are going to be extremely receptive to this information now. As I said before, you know, people are apathetic when they hear about 9/11. Well, it didn't affect me. I didn't get killed. My wife didn't get killed. So I don't care who did 9/11. That's the lazy, immoral attitude that these people have. However, when they find out, hey, look, you and your family and millions of others are going to fry on the surface of Earth in a couple of years because solar scorching is about to occur. We have tremendous solar hyperactivity documented by the National Academy of Science in the article that was put right up in our face on Jesse Ventura's wonderful True TV expose, Apocalypse 2012, which is on the, you can Google.
Well, NASA's been warning us. NASA has been warning us that there's going to be these killer solar flares coming.
That's right. And we saw the actual newspaper articles from that.
And so this is what they're talking about, probably, is flares from Planet X. Because that makes more sense.
Flares from the sun.
Do you think it's going to be flares from our sun?
Well, if we're between the sun and Planet X, then we're right between that plasma stream. Okay, between the two suns.
Exactly. You see, Planet X, when it came through the heliosphere, and scientists are just beginning to realize that there's an electric universe. The mainstream is very slow to accept, you know, new ideas when they conflict with their own ensconced beliefs.
Thunderbolt.com.
Power structure.
Thunderbolt.com?
That's right. Thunderbolts.info, right?
Wallace
Thornhill.
What's that?
And Frank Jurgens, incidentally. Frank Jurgens was the guy who originally had that thought about the electric comets. And that goes back even before Frank Jurgens in the 1970s. It goes back to the 1880s when in scientific magazines scientists were speculating that this cometary glowing and tail and the tail effect of comets was due to electrical charge on the comets. Getting back to what happens when the comet comes in, it punches through the heliosphere, which is a huge plasma-composed sphere surrounding our entire solar system. The plasma, incidentally, is built up by the sun blowing out solar winds comprised of both positive electrical charges and negative electrical charges. But the positive electrical charges are about 2,000 times more massive than the electrons, which are blown out. So naturally, the more massive particles will go further. And this is my own, I think this could be scientifically backed up, although I haven't read it, just based on my knowledge of basic physics, it makes sense that more protons would build up in the outer reaches of our solar system because, again, the proton is about 2,000 times more massive than the electron. So now we have this plasma sphere surrounding the entire solar system, and Planet X now punches through just as a bee would punch through a bubblegum bubble coming from the outside to the inside. That bee would take up a whole stream of bubblegum and pull it in and create a huge tail of bubblegum to the point where the bubblegum would stretch and stretch as the bee flew closer to the inner solar system or inside the bubble. And then finally, that bubblegum would lose its connection to the outer bubble, and it would pull and it would snap. Now, if you were to take a slow motion picture of that bubblegum tail snapping back into the bee, you would see a whiplash effect. You would see a whipping, an undulation of this bubblegum.
And a forward thrust, wouldn't it?
Pardon me?
Wouldn't there be an intense forward thrust at that snap?
A forward thrust?
Yes.
There would be, except that there's not very much mass to a trail of protons, so it's not going to really affect that massive comet, the comet's nucleus, very much. However, these electrons, or that bubblegum, compared to this, you know, that sticky bubblegum, would be then translated into the reality of the electrically sticky plasma. And you know, plasma electrical particles are sticky because when you touch something that's like a styrofoam packing peanuts inside of a box that they get sent to you, they stick to your hands. You can't get them off. It's like glue, you know, but it's electrostatic electricity. Well, anyway, this plasma drenched comet comes in and its tail snaps just with a whipping motion, just as we described in that analogy. And this is exactly what the ancient Chinese civilization saw. The people who survived the last incursions of Planet X, they looked up in the sky and they saw this red, glowing, monstrous comet with a huge roller coaster-like tail. It looked like just like a serpent, a sea serpent, red and glowing. And the legend was passed on from generation to generation, and it was enacted. The legend died, but the choreography remained to this day. When you go to Chinatown on Chinese New Year, you will see them do the dragon dance. There's a costume that looks like a red flowing tunnel, and they have men inside of it, and one man jumps up, and the other man squats down, and they jump up and down alternately inside this red flowing tunnel, and it looks like a roller coaster. It looks like a whiplashing dragon. Mm-hmm. That describes what their ancestors saw, and they don't know. They don't realize the true origin of that legendary choreography. Isn't that amazing, though?
Yes, mm-hmm. I always wondered what the red dragon in the sky was all about.
Yeah, there's so many allusions to that. Zechariah Sitchin states in his book, The Twelfth Planet. I've got the book right here. I know the page. I could just read a brief excerpt. It's kind of intriguing. Let's see. It's around page 240 of The Twelfth Planet by Zechariah Sitchin, a world-famous archaeologist and anthropologist.
And UFOlogist.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's right. I forgot about that. He says here.
Someone had sent us some Zechariah Sitchin books.
Someone has sent us a couple of Zechariah Sitchin books.
Yeah, someone has.
Recently, one of his promoters, I guess. Mm-hmm. Publicist. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
It says here on page 240, quote, wherever archaeologists uncovered the remains of Near Eastern peoples, the symbol of the winged globe was conspicuous, dominating temples and palaces, carved on rocks, etched on cylinder seals, painted on walls. It accompanied kings and priests, stood above their thrones, hovered above them in battle scenes, was etched into their chariots. Clay, metal, stone, and wood objects were adorned with the symbol. The rulers of Sumer and Akkad, Babylon and Assyria, etc., etc., all revered the symbol. Hittite kings, Egyptian pharaohs, Persian shahs, all proclaimed the symbol and what it stood for, supreme. It remained so for millennia. central to the religious beliefs and astronomy of the ancient world was the conviction that the 12th planet, the planet of the gods, remained within the solar system and that its grand orbit returned it periodically to Earth's vicinity. The pictographic sign for the 12th planet, the planet of crossing, was a cross. This cuneiform sign, the cross, evolved in the Semitic languages to the letter Tau, Tav, which means the sign. So it's really amazing how this wing globe took on the sign of the cross. Well, the Sumerians, were the ancient people who dwelled in Babylon, and what is now the Tigris and Euphrates Valley around Iraq, present-day Iraq, those Sumerian people thousands of years ago saw this planet come in, and it must have been about three passages. So each passage, of course, is roughly 3,600 years apart, because this huge brown dwarf star is on a cometary orbit, and comets like pendulum, are very regular in their orbital cycles, their period, that is, the orbital period. 3,660 years happens to be the orbital period of this planet. We have lots of evidence. We have ecological evidence that 3,660 years ago, tree rings on petrified trees were found to have very narrow tree rings dating back to the year around 3,600 years ago. And this would be because volcanoes around the world will have exploded and created a black cloud shrouding the sunlight for several years. It would be like a nuclear winter. And consequently, all vegetation suffered from light deprivation. So there's ecological...
Did you find that all over the world, or do you know? Or just in certain places?
I'm not sure. Mark Hazelwood had taken this out of some of the books that he read, and he noted that in his book, Blindsided, of 2001, and it probably would be all over the world. We have cultures, again, stating that they have noticed they have been devastated by this, all cultures the world over. And Dr. Emmanuel Velikovsky lined up the dates of these records because there was an error in the calendars of various civilizations, and most scientists did not want to believe that all these records, these accounts from various civilizations of a huge catastrophe in their country could all have occurred at the same time in history. Well, Velikovsky found errors in the calendars and then lined up these calendars, made the corrections, and found that all these dates recorded by various civilizations of great catastrophes were all at the same period in history.
And now, what civilizations are we talking about?
Talking about this Chinese civilization, Emperor Yaotu, I believe his name is, or Yahoo, I'm not sure. I know there's a man who speaks about it, and somebody wrote about it, too. I can get more documentation to corroborate this. But the Emperor of China, in his imperial annals, during the time of the Exodus, the Egyptians' exodus from Egypt, would have been around 1660 B.C., the Emperor of China...
When did you say that was? I didn't quite hear you. What year was that?
Around 1660 B.C.
Okay.
The Emperor of China recorded in his imperial annals that the sun remained out. The sun, their country was lit by sunlight for at least 3 days. There was tremendous catastrophe, one of which was extreme epic flooding. It took them about 12 years to dig canals to drain the water out of these canals. And they said the sun was out for 3 days. Now, on the other side of the world, the Mayan, the Mexican, and the Aztec civilizations, civilizations in Central and South America recorded darkness for 3 days, which is logical. If the world, the planet Earth, paused in its rotation, you would have had an extended period of sunlight on one side of the world, China, while the other side of the world would have been had the same extended period of darkness.
Are you saying in China there was 3 days of just solid light?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't catch that. So, okay.
So we have a great deal of ancient historical evidence only because, I mean, you know, evidence that is linked together by this periodic, this predictable period, this orbital period of Planet X. 3,660 years ago was the explosion of the Santorini volcano. That, again, is a great geological discovery. They have found that this volcanic explosion was the greatest, from geological evidence, the greatest explosion they've ever recorded from ancient history to this day. Their evidence shows that it had a volcanic explosive index of 6.4, I believe, something, you know, unheard of. Mm. And this was at the very same time that in the book of Exodus, chapter 9, God speaks to Moses and Aaron and tells them to scoop up handfuls of ashes from the furnace, throw them up in the air in the face of Pharaoh and his magicians. And God says to Moses, these ashes will come down as hot cinders over the faces of Pharaoh and all the land of Egypt. It states all the land of Egypt. Well, at that moment, it was divinely ordained that a certain period before that moment, this volcano would explode, and enough time was given for the volcanic ash cloud to drift south from its origin in the Aegean Sea, just west of Greece, down south to the country as a nation of Egypt. So there you have more evidence where all these sources, biblical sources, converge with geological mm-hmm. sources and ecological sources.
Now,
the evidence just gets
that 40 years when the Jews were told to leave Egypt, the Exodus, that was happening, do you think, before or during or after this event?
It's actually the 10 plagues of Egypt were what God brought to caused such trauma to Pharaoh and the people of Egypt that they would release the people, the Israelites, from Egypt. Mm-hmm. So these catastrophes occurred with a lead up to the actual crescendo of Planet X's disasters, the very peak. The lead up to it was the time of 10 plagues, culminating in the final exodus of the people.
I think I remember the movie Exodus where the fireballs were coming down from the sky or something.
That's right. And that would be the flaming rocks that are pulled down. There's gravitational attraction between these close passing bodies. This passing body was probably not Planet X, but one of its gang, its swarm of surrounding comets, which it pulls in. This Planet X is like a beehive, you know. It's with bees swarming all around it, and each little bee is like a comet. Varying size celestial bodies ranging in size from small planets to comets to meteors, asteroids, boulders, rocks, and even as small particles as red iron oxide dust, which engulfs the planet. And we have photographs now showing that red mist that have been, again, coming from some released photographs that the government took. This object is engulfed in a red glow of dust. Mm-hmm. And when it comes by, it or surrounding comets will sweep the Earth, and this red dust will pollute the waters. And this is how the waters probably turned red in the book of Exodus. They were made, you know, unfit to drink. Cause great sickness.
Well, that's going to happen again here, right, John?
Yeah, all these things are bound to happen again. In fact, if you read the book of Revelation mm-hmm. is Exodus deja vu all over again.
Yes.
I mean, if
just
you want to know what's going to happen, read the book of Exodus in the Bible, and you'll find out what's about to happen. And then read the book of Revelation, because it tells you, too. It says fire and blood raining down.
Mm-hmm.
Fire mingled with blood raining down on the earth. And then it says in Revelation chapter 16 that the sun, the first, third angel, or whatever angel, poured out its vial upon the earth, and it scorched, the sun scorched all of mankind, mm-hmm. something to that effect. And that would be called caused by the solar scorching that's occurring. You
right.
know, so the sun gets very highly excited by these electrical discharges that as these planets come close, they discharge their plasma into the sun because the sun has an excess of electrons in a space charge surrounding it. Remember, it blew out those protons and electrons, but now it blew out the photons further because they're more massive.
Mm-hmm.
So more electrons hang around the inner solar system. Consequently, the sun becomes has an excess of electrons, whereas Planet X and these comets coming in from the plasmatic boundaries of our solar system are drenched in an excess of protons. And as we know, plus and minus attract, just like male and female attract, mm-hmm. very, very forcefully attract. Well, the protons want to come close, and that's one of the reasons why this tail of protons from the comet, suddenly pulls up and draws up close to the nucleus of the comet, and the tail becomes part of the glowing coma around the comet because the protons are being drawn ever more forcefully as they approach the negatively charged sun. And that's what makes the tail disappear, draw up close to around the nucleus. And then suddenly, as it gets closer, the object gets closer to the sun, it glows more and more brightly. And you'll see that in the sky when you see comets that have come in. And there'll be many more comets you'll be seeing coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Those comets will glow each night. You'll see them get brighter and brighter. They're much too bright to be a star. You know that. You can see it. And then when they get close enough to the sun, what will happen is all that plasma will suddenly zap positive plasma to the negatively charged sun
mm-hmm.
and discharge. Just as your hand, you would feel a zap when you touch your car door on a cold day and your body has an excess of a static electricity.
So we're going to be right in the middle of a lightning bolt.
That's right. There'll be lightning bolts. And these lightning bolts create X-rays. That's how you create X-rays,
uh-huh.
high voltage electrical discharges, like just like lightning. And they've put up these satellites, so many solar observatories between the NASA and the European Space Agency and the Japanese Space Agency. They're all working collectively. They've put up an extraordinary number of space solar observatories in space to view all this phenomenon that's about to occur. So the evidence is mountainous, and what are we going to do about it? We're going to teach people to prepare.
Mm-hmm.
We have to deal with the physical, how to protect ourselves from the straight-line wind storms, and I have some suggestions in that regard. People can keep in their mind, and that is to, first of all, protect the roof of your house. I had a new roof put on last year. It was a matter of paying either $7,000 for a poor job, or paying $8,000 for a very good roofing job. So I paid the $8,000. I found the only roofer who's been in the business for four generations who uses a hammer and nails. That's the only kind of guy you want to find.
Mm-hmm.
Copper nails, not galvanized nails. Anyway, he told me, boy, when you get these guys, why copper nails? Copper nails, because they don't rust out. If you take a galvanized nail and put it in a bucket of water, he told me, mm-hmm. all the iron or the steel inside the galvanized nail will rot out. The galvanized coating will remain, but the nail itself will rot. So this man has been, he showed me his credentials. He showed me a picture of the truck that his great-grandfather used in his first roofing business, the year 1905, their roofing truck. Well, anyway, he told me also that when they hammer these, when he put these nails in, the guys who normally with their nail guns, they want to go boom, 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 real fast and get the job done. What they do is miss that critical line. There's a line on the shingle that shows exactly where to put that nail. If they miss that line, they actually miss the shingle beneath it. And so now you have shingles that are going to come off very soon after the roof is put on.
Mm-hmm.
And this roofer said he does not want to come back to service the roofs after people complain that the shingles are coming off. So he says that's the only way he does it, with a hammer and copper nails. That's the kind of guy you want to find.
Wow. Well, John, we're out of time.
Okay.
We're out of time. God, just so much in preparation for this return of planets.
Well, if you got a minute,
John, if you have
while,
some time, I'd like to have you on next week, and we can talk about what you think people should do about this information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's so many things we can do to protect ourselves.
All right, well, I'd like to have you on next week on BNN, and We can kick it around.
Okay. I appreciate your invitation.
Okay.
We thank you very much for your information.
Yes. Yeah, we want to thank you for coming on the show today. This is John DiNardo. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming on today's show. Coming up next is Michael Elejon and his communication with these cosmic beings. That's next on Vortex Network News. Have a great day, everyone.